Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. In this week's episode, we are going out of this world to learn about a new way of cleaning up pesky dust on the moon. And we'll also be chatting about the film Proxima, which looks at motherhood, separation, and the experience of women in male-dominated fields, all through the eyes of an astronaut who is about to blast off to the International Space Station. But first, something much closer to home in these uncertain times. For almost 75 years, the doomsday clock of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has monitored how close humankind is to global catastrophe. With the clock now closer to midnight than ever before, the science journalist Rachel Brazil has written an article for Physics World that explains how the clock is set. Here is Rachel in conversation with Physics World's Mateen Durrani about the doomsday clock.
So I'm delighted to be joined by Rachel Brazil, who's a freelance writer in London. You might remember a few months ago she wrote a great feature about fighting flat earthers. And now, Rachel, you've just written another feature, Physics World, all about the doomsday clock. Hi, Rachel. How are you?
Hi, I'm very good. How are you?
Good. Right, let's start with the basics. I mean, not everyone knows what the doomsday clock is. So for those who don't know what it is, do you want to remind people what that device is?
Yes. So the doomsday clock is essentially a communication tool, a communication device, and it's run by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And essentially, it's their way of explaining to the public, to policymakers, the kind of level of risk of a kind of humanity-ending threat. So they're looking at the really big threats to our world and trying to communicate that. And they've created this clock. The bulletin itself was founded in 1945 by two Chicago physicists who were involved in the Manhattan Project. I think a lot of Manhattan Project physicists, initially there was a real push towards the Manhattan Project because there was a lot of fear of Germany during the war acquiring nuclear weapons. But I think after that didn't happen, after the war, after the explosions in Japan, there was a lot of fear from physicists about the dangers of these weapons and a feeling of that there was their responsibility to do something about it. So the bulletin was devised to discuss these issues. And a few years after the bulletin came about, it actually came from a cover design that someone had done for the bulletin, had this picture of a clock on it. And from that, they had this idea, well, let's design this tool to really try and communicate, you know, how risky a situation we're in. And it sort of developed from there. The initial editor, Eugene Rabinovich, used to set the clock. And when he passed away, they formed a science and technology board full of very eminent physicists and policymakers. And they took over setting the clock. And now, for the last 75 years, the clock has every January, they've sort of announced how many seconds to midnight it is. In Washington, D.C., it's announced every year and tends to get quite a lot of media attention as a real sort of measure of what's happened in that year.
Yeah, obviously started in 1947, and the clock's kind of gone backwards and forwards over the years as the sort of, I guess, the geopolitical situation has changed. But the big news earlier this year in January was that it was set to 100 seconds to midnight. Now, that was the furthest forward it's ever been. So what were the reasons for sort of shifting it so close to doomsday?
So I spoke to Rachel Brunson, who is the chair of the bulletin, and she said really that it was really just simply because the board believed that we are now at the most dangerous time we've been in the 75 years that the clock has been around, and that what sort of contributed to that is sort of the end to some of the nuclear weapons reduction treaties. I think the last treaty in place called New Start ends in February 2021. Obviously, the end of the Iran nuclear deal. And all this, actually, that the clock was set before the pandemic started. So all this is our existing problems that they perceived before the pandemic. But I think the pandemic has actually brought into focus some of the other issues they had flagged, which were really ideas about a weak leadership and lack of global cooperation, which mean that when, you know, problems are rising, there's no effective way of dealing with them. And they also flagged up, which I think we've seen as well, this proliferation of disinformation and the idea that it's now very difficult to tell sort of the truth from the lies and actually get messages across. So all those issues kind of came together to make them set the clock as near as it's been to midnight.
Yeah, and one of the factors that they now include is climate change, and that decision to include climate change in their deliberations goes back to 2007, and it was quite controversial when members of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists started including that. I mean, do you think broadening the remit beyond just nuclear has kind of made the clock's rationale a bit sort of questionable, a bit woolly?
Well, I think it has been a controversial issue and still is for some people. And it certainly was an issue that they thought about long and hard, I think. But if you actually look at some of these statements from the original people who devised the clock, so Rabinowitz, the first editor of the Bulletin, one of the sort of very well-known statements that he said was that the Bulletin was about assessing, was that they were trying to manage the dangerous presence of Pandora's box of modern science. That was a really nice statement he came up with, which shows you that they were, even at that time, thinking about not just nuclear threat, but how science in general and new science was going to, affect us. And so I think it's not out of character. They have started looking at new areas like things like synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, and of course climate change. I think it's difficult to say. I mean, clearly some people think that it's a divergent, it's become sort of more of a blunt tool. But the clock still does catch the attention of the press every year. And clearly there are other threats that we need to think about.
Yeah. And one of the things you mentioned, obviously, the clock was started just after the Second World War in the wake of the Manhattan Project and the bombs on Japan. I mean, there's been this really close link between the clock and the physics community. So how has that sort of changed over the years? There is still quite a bit of involvement from physicists, aren't there?
Yeah. That's very interesting. I spoke to Robert Rosner, who's the chair of the Science and Technology Board, and he sort of talked interestingly about how the relationship has changed with physics. Clearly, in the 40s and 50s, physics was really key to the debate about nuclear threat. And he says there was a sort of special period in the post-war years where physicists were incredibly engaged in these kind of arguments. But that has decreased over the years. It was interesting. He talked about some physicists being uncomfortable with ideas of uncertainty, with the sorts, if you think about the sort of climate change debates, how there is uncertainty in there. And he says that he was involved in setting the American Physics Society policy on climate change. I think this was sort of maybe 10 years ago. And he said he had a very difficult job trying to manage sort of other physicists' ideas of what kind of statements they should be saying when there was so much uncertainty. So, I mean, that those kind of ideas, I think he sort of thinks that sometimes physicists aren't necessarily comfortable in sort of campaigning roles. But even so, I mean, if you look up to sort of the 1980s, physicists were still playing quite a key role in the sort of nuclear debate. And for example, the debates in the 1980s about the US ballistic missiles defense system that was planned. A lot of physicists were speaking about that and explaining sort of the technical difficulties and how it might not be such a good idea. And I mean, I think generally, if we look today, nuclear issues are not, for physicists and for the general public, they're not at the front of everybody's minds. They are gaining less attention. So perhaps it's just natural that they would be getting less attention in the physics community too. But it's certainly something that organisations like the Bulletin have noticed and would like to change, would like to get more physicists engaged.
Yeah, and that was one of the themes of your feature, Rachel. You talked to a number of physicists who want to sort of strengthen that link between the clock and the physics community. And they're sort of making the point that physicists need to do more to tackle the threats of global disaster. That's true, isn't it? You talked to quite a few, well, several.
I think the Bulletin would say that it wants all scientists engaged, and that today, obviously, because there are so many threats, we need biologists and artificial intelligence specialists, but they are still very keen to engage physicists. And I know a group of physicists, some of them are engaged with the Bulletin, but also I think they've been funded by the American Physics Society. They have started going round universities in the US to try and talk to physicists and engage colleagues in starting to lobby their congressional representatives, start to really talk about this issue and talk about these nuclear threats, especially with the end of some of the nuclear agreements that have been in place for many years. And obviously in the UK, we do have groups. We have groups like Scientists for Global Responsibility who campaign for scientists to be engaged in these kinds of issues and to think about the responsibility they have for their work. And to really sort of take those issues on board.
Now, Rachel, you mentioned that the clock is currently 100 seconds to midnight. And of course, that was decided before the whole COVID-19 pandemic really took hold. So the next meeting of the board is in November. So what's your personal view? Do you think the clock will move still closer to midnight? Or what would you do if it was your decision?
I think it's quite difficult to say, but my feeling would be it's going to be very dependent on what happens in the US elections in November. So, you know, I think it could go either way, really, depending on whether on who is the next president, as to whether the feeling is we're more or less safe. Obviously, with the pandemic, it's clear that we haven't been taking risks, general risks, as seriously. I mean, the pandemic is not a human-made risk, but we're clearly unprepared. And I know several people I spoke to talked about some of the sort of exercises that governments regularly do to consider risks and how the results of these exercises are generally ignored. So there's certainly lots of indications that we're not taking risks seriously. Personally, you know, I'm not sure I'm qualified to sort of judge these things, and I'll be very happy to hear what the Bulletin, what the Science and Technology Board, you know, the conclusion they come to next January, and see what they think.
Well, I did a very unscientific poll on Twitter, Physics World Twitter followers, Rachel. So 44% said they would move it even closer, 16% leave it unchanged, 22% move it backwards, and 18%. Don't know what the doomsday clock is, so maybe there's a bit more public relations about what the nature of the clock is still to come.
That's interesting. As I said, I think there's a lot to play for in the next few months, and what happens with the US election might make a big difference as to, you know, what the board decides. We shall see.
All right. Well, thanks, Rachel. I hope we're still around by the time the next decision is made. In the meantime, yes. Anyone can read your feature on the Physics World website. So thanks again, Rachel, and hope to speak to you soon.
Great to speak to you.
That was Rachel Brazil and Mateen Durrani. You can find Rachel's article on the Physics World website. Just look for the headline, Doomsday Clock Clicks Closer to Disaster, and that's in the feature section. The moon is a dusty place, and that could pose significant problems for future colonizers, particularly because the dust is very sticky. I'm joined down the line by Xu Wang and Ben Farr at the University of Colorado at Boulder, who have invented a dust buster for lunar dust that could help future colonizers with this problem. Hi, guys.
Hi, Hamish.
Hi, Hamish.
So Xu, why is it so dusty on the moon? And why would this be a problem for future colonizers?
So yeah, the moon is very dusty. I think they're basically, I'm not a planetary scientist, but I can tell you what I have understood. So basically there are two processes can make a very fine dust grains. When you imagine early time, asteroids that bombarded the lunar surface, and you see this big impact craters. So that can generate a lot of small rocks, and then after that, because moon has no air, so it's continuously bombarded by meteoroids and micrometeoroids. So those can break up big rocks into very tiny fine dust particles. Another process is called thermal fragmentation. Because again, the moon has no air. The day side is very hot. It's more than 100 Celsius high. And at night, it can be very cold, negative 200 degrees C. So the entire surface will go through this very hot, cold thermal cycle. And that can cause thermal fragmentation. It can cause cracks on big rocks, then keep cracking down, and that becomes a very small particles. So that makes, this process has been going through, for millions and millions of years. And you can imagine this is how they can make a lot of dust grains.
And I assume the problem is it's not a sort of an aesthetic problem. This dust, I'm guessing, could get into machinery, it could get into equipment and cause some real problems.
Yes, so that's the lunar dust is very jagged shapes, just like a broken shards of glass. They virtually stick to all surfaces. And, it can damage spacesuits, obstruct optical lenses. One example is lunar retroreflector reflector. They saw the degradation over time that's maybe caused by the dust covering. If it deposits on solar panels, it can cut off the output power. It can cause overheat of thermal radiators when it's covered by dust. Of course, it can clog mechanical joints.
And Ben, it's this dust is really sticky. Why is it sticky? Why is it difficult to get off these surfaces?
So there's a few reasons that it's really sticky. The first one is just the size. The dust is incredibly, incredibly fine. It's a lot of the time less than 25 microns. So it's very, very small. So it can kind of get in all the grooves of like a spacesuit or in joints or something like that. So there's the physical size of it. It makes it very, very sticky. And then the shape of it, like she was talking about a second ago, it is a lot like broken pieces of glass. So it has a way of just kind of working its way into stuff and just staying there. And further than that, it is charged. So it gets bombarded with solar wind all the time, which means that the dust itself carries an electric charge. And that causes it to stick to everything pretty much. And that's the big thing. So It really does stick to everything. Glass, metal, spacesuits, skin, everything.
And Shu, it's this electrical charge that's sort of the key to your dustbuster system, isn't it? You're actually using an electron beam to remove the dust. How does this work?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And that's also the key development we had. Very interesting. It came out actually from our scientific studies about how lunar dust that can be naturally lofted by electrostatic forces. If you do the calculation, back of envelope calculation, that can tell you the charge is actually very small. And sure, they are charged, but doesn't mean they can be lofted. So then what we found, the key thing is, we made breakthroughs in recent lab experiments. So there are host gaps between dust particles. We call them macro cavities. And what happens if you have electron beam or even photons hitting the bottom dust particles, that generate additional electrons. We call it secondary electrons. These secondary electrons will be absorbed inside those macro cavities. No, they don't go out. They were charged. Dust particles forming the macro cavities, and this charge is very large. It's because the cavity is so small, the electric field is huge. That gives you an enormous charge, negative charge on those particles, and then those negative charges, they will repel each other because they have same polarity, right? That ejects dust off the surface. And so this is, we studied, we understood this fundamental mechanism from scientific studies, and we said, why not we use this to shade dust? It's same mechanism. So this is we ended with this the development.
So essentially, you're charging up the dust, and once it gathers a lot of charge, the individual dust particles repel each other. And so the dust sort of breaks apart and goes away. Is that the idea?
Yes.
And Ben, how would you actually do this on the moon? Would you have a sort of an electron generator that would send electrons onto equipment and into equipment to get the dust out? Is that how it would work?
So we've actually got a couple different ideas depending on the actual application. So we want to make a handheld device that astronauts could actually use while they're on the lunar surface or, you know, outside of a spacecraft or something like that, just so they could clean off small devices or, you know, like more delicate equipment. And then we also want to make, or not necessarily make, but we've had an idea to do like a electron chamber inside the spacecraft that you could put the spacesuit or larger equipment in and clean off the entire thing all at one time. So it's not really just one device that we have. It's just kind of taking this idea and applying it to a whole bunch of different things.
And Shu, what about here on Earth? Are there any applications for this new sort of technique that you've developed? Could it be useful here on Earth, perhaps in dusty environments, or maybe for something completely different?
Yeah, I can tell you the it works the best in vacuum conditions, which, for example, the moon, it's perfect vacuum, right? In atmosphere, it won't work very well because the electron beam will get scattered, will be slowed down, so the energy will be reduced. So, but in some, you know, manufacturing, for example, I know the semiconductor, they make semiconductor chips. So that's in they do plasma processing. That's in the vacuum chamber. One of the issues that can grow dust on the surface of the wafer. And this may be a possible application for removing those dust, but it may not work because it's a very different situation. It's just sort of like an idea that may work in those kind of environments.
And Ben, are you looking forward to doing any further research on busting dust on the moon, maybe developing complementary or alternative technologies to the electron beam system?
Yeah, we are. So not really alternative stuff. We're still testing the electron beam and trying to figure out the limit of the system, because our previous research, we found that we could get about 80% of the dust off of any given surface. So right now we're trying to figure out techniques to get that remaining 20%, because that's still pretty significant that we want to get off. So we're actually running tests currently to try and get that remaining part off. And those tests are including like changing the angle between the beam and the dust. We're playing around with different beam energies or pressures. And we are messing with some other kind of add-ons to the technology, like adding on a metal mesh in front of the beam to kind of get rid of some space charging that occurs. So we are looking into adjusting or modifying the system. And then once we figure that out, we do want to actually start doing some more engineering applications and design a more tangible device that we could actually present to NASA or somebody like that. So we do have a lot of work still to do about you know, plenty to keep me busy for the next year or so.
You can find a link to the team's paper about their lunar dustbuster on the Physics World website. Just look for the headline, Dustbuster for the Moon, in the blog section. Ben and Shu, good luck with your further research into this, and thanks for being on the Physics World Weekly podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
So thanks for having us.
Proxima is the latest feature film from the French screenwriter and director Alice Winocur. It stars Eva Green as an astronaut, and it takes place in the weeks before she departs for a 12-month stay on the International Space Station. The focus of the film is the relationship between Sarah and her daughter Stella as Sarah prepares for her departure. There are no warp drives or time travel in the plot, but it has captured the imagination of Physics World's reviews editor and science fiction fan, Tushna Commissariat, who joins me now. Hi, Tushna.
Hi, Hamish. Good to be on the podcast again.
Thanks for joining us. So what were your impressions of this film?
So it was kind of funny because we finished watching the film and I was like, huh, you know, it was one of those films where you're not quite sure straight off the bat how you felt about it. You know, I needed a bit of time to think about it. But after having done so, it was a very good and very powerful film. It's so not typical of what you expect from sort of the current sci-fi kind of films, or even films about astronauts and things like that. It was really different. And it was really much more about human relationships than anything. So a very different take, but I did really enjoy it. I did, yeah.
And you commissioned a science fiction super fan, I think it's safe to call him that, Andrew Glester, to review the film for Physics World. So how did Andrew cope with the lack of warp drives or time travel? Did he like the film?
Yeah, he did. So you'll be amused to hear that Andrew and I actually watched this film together. And by that, I mean that we watched it through during the lockdown, actually, or just maybe as the first lockdown was easing. Through the lockdown, we've been watching sci-fi films together, i.e. Andrew and a bunch of our other friends. We'd sit down at the same time together and, you know, load up the films and then watch them together and then chat about them afterwards. So Proxima was one of the films that we kind of watched together. And then Andrew, he really enjoyed it and he had lots of thoughts about it too. So, we were chatting about it after we watched it and he had so many things to say. So I was kind of laughing and by the end of it, he was like, right, yes, I will write a review about that. and he decided that he was going to try and get in touch with the director, Alice, which he did, and he managed to interview her too. So that made it quite an interesting thing. I think it was good having Andrew on there too, because Andrew is a parent, and so and he has a young daughter, and they're very close. And so I really wanted to hear Andrew's take about it as a parent and what he saw in that kind of aspect. But Andrew's wife, Jenny, she joined us too when we were watching the film, and it was really interesting that Jenny had the most sort of interesting take on it, because at the end of the day, this really is a film about being a mother and an astronaut. And it's really quite a powerful feminist take, I would say, in the end, because it shows you that the picture is not all rosy. And really what the film is about how difficult it is for this astronaut, Sarah, as a pretty much a single parent. She and the father of her daughter, Stella, are split up, and Stella lives with her and they have this really close relationship. And the film is then really about how Sarah's trying desperately to maintain this relationship and make sure her daughter is happy while dealing with all the stresses of being an astronaut, but not just being an astronaut, being a female astronaut, and trying to deal with all of the sexism, whether it's the training aspect of it or whether it is how she maintains being a mother while dealing with the various people around her, like her ex-partner, who the daughter goes to live with, and his many failings. He was probably the most frustrating character in the film for me. So he's a scientist too. I think he was, they mentioned that he works in the Mars rover or something like that. And he's so caught up in his life and that, that she's really nervous about leaving Stella with her, but she does. And then it's about how they all deal with that.
And it sounds like this film will really resonate with women working in science, you know, not just astronauts. Do you see the film as a realistic portrayal of the challenges facing women in science and engineering?
Absolutely, yeah. And what the film does is that it does that. There's a couple of scenes, like there's this one scene where, it's one of their training days and she's struggling with the training because it's hard, you know, which, I mean, all the astronauts are struggling to some extent, but, you know, she's really struggling with it in general. I think it's one of the days where she stays behind for a few extra minutes to try and get her daughter on the phone, trying to deal with time differences because at this point they're in Russia and training there. And she ends up being 3 minutes late for training that day and just basically gets told, "You're late, you can't participate today." And it's this very sort of toxic masculine environment at that point. And you can see the like anger and frustration on her face where she's trying to manage and juggle all of these things. And you really think, like, you know, I was sitting there thinking, surely you wouldn't just tell someone who's training to be an astronaut, "You're 3 minutes late, you can't participate today." You know, but that's exactly what happens. And that was one of those things that actually I asked Andrew to ask Alice that, you know, do you think that this would actually happen? And Alice was like, "Oh yeah, I absolutely think this would actually happen. And I think a lot worse than this happens." And so as part of the film, Alice and actually the actress Ava Green, who is phenomenal in her portrayal of Sarah, they actually spent a lot of time at ESA and they met with so many astronauts past and present, and especially so many female astronauts, and got these stories off of them. And I think Alice was saying that, you know, the stories that she heard were way worse than being kicked off training for one day. But as she put it, that the female astronauts don't necessarily talk about that, don't make a big deal of that, because if they do want to continue, if they do want to go into space and they do want to be able to be there, it's hard enough getting into that room. So then, you know, you're not going to make a big fuss about all the awful stuff. You kind of suck it up just so that you can be there. And that's the reality of it. And that's probably the reality of it for many women in science.
One thing that Andrew did mention in his review is the setting for the film. I understand it was actually shot on location, where astronauts train and also where rockets launch in Kazakhstan. How is the setting? Did you enjoy seeing that?
Yeah, that was really cool, actually. It's really cool seeing that. And it was they did absolutely film all of it on location in Star City and in Baikonur. And it's kind of, you know, what's really cool is that you get to see them literally checking in. You get to see the rooms that they live in and things like that. And it was really interesting to see what that's really like. It's, you know, the hotels that they live in while they're training in that. It's got this like really funky 70s vibe, which I kind of didn't expect. And yeah, what was interesting was that Alice mentions in her interview that they actually had like three different crews. So they had or more. They had a German crew, a Russian crew, a French crew, and a Kazakh crew, because they filmed in all of these different places, which included the ESA headquarters, and then where Sarah was based initially, and then where the father was based, and then where they go off to train. So and I think that it's probably one of the first feature films in Hollywood that was filmed at a location like this, and that was not filmed at NASA, you know, because you're so used to seeing NASA and what it looks like, but really majority of the astronauts don't train there. Once they start training for these bigger missions, they go and train in Russia. And so it was really wonderful seeing that. Absolutely.
It's an interesting part of the world, that, because, you know, it's such a huge area, but you don't really hear much about, about Kazakhstan. You don't see films located in that region. It's really nice, actually, that, that there is a space film that doesn't involve Houston and, yeah. And Cape Canaveral.
Absolutely. And there are actually quite a few scenes. There's bits where they train, where they're out in a lot of this like beautiful forest and lake area. There's one bit where they literally they have to go camping overnight, just the three of them. I can't remember why, but I think it's supposed to be like, depending on where they land or something, that they might have to camp out for a bit. So they have this like overnight camp out, just the three of them would be a part of the crew. And then you also see them learning what it's like when they do land in water and how they would get out and do all those kinds of things. So yeah, it's a completely different aesthetic to that very typical American narrative that you normally see. So I definitely really enjoyed that. I definitely enjoyed seeing this very new world, I would say.
Good stuff. Well, you can read Andrew Glester's review of Proxima on the Physics World website. Just look for the headline, Proxima Review, Bonds Beyond the Bounds of Earth. And you'll find that in the opinion and reviews section of the website. And Tushna, you're a regular guest on Andrew's podcast, The Cosmic Shed. And I think that you're going to be talking much more about Proxima in an upcoming episode. Is that right?
Yes, Hamish, that is absolutely right. So check it out in about a month's time if you want to know all the details about Proxima.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Tushna. Thanks for being on the Physics World Weekly podcast.
Always a pleasure, Hamish.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Rachel Brazil, Shu Wang, Ben Farr, Mateen Durrani, and Tushna Commissariat for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.